Well, we're back, and we're joined by Neela Schwartzberg, who has a very, very interesting article, and it's called Experiencing History Firsthand. And Neela, and then you go on to say, well, first of all, good morning to you.
Good morning.
I've got a little, you know, it's we're here in sunny Florida, and it's 60 degrees, and I'm chilly. My brain is frozen this morning.
Oh, man, have you had enough caffeine?
I don't know. But let's just get back to that. You say experiencing history firsthand, and then you go on to say, when I was in school, history was my least favorite subject. Now, I might say that as well, but tell us what life experience changed all that for you.
Well, you know, there's something about not having to do something that gives you the space to look around and see how horrible or not horrible it really was. And I guess I discovered that history was more interesting than I had experienced it when I was in school. And I started reading historical novels, and I loved them. I mean, you know, good, solid, well-researched. And I realized that history can be really interesting and exciting because it is the story of people and their actions.
First of all, if you could speak up just a little bit more, Neela. You have such a lovely, soft voice that sometimes we lose you out there. You said that you discovered historical fiction, mm-hmm. and then you discovered historical travel,
right.
and that got you hooked.
Yes, because history is not the memorization of dates that we do in school. It is people's actions, and they play out their lives on a grand stage, and we look back at it and call it history, and just because it's convenient, we assign dates to it and people, and then we make our children memorize that stuff. It's just they're going to understand what was actually going on.
Exactly.
So when I discovered historical fiction and then travel with a historical flair, I realized history is tremendously exciting, and there are all kinds of stories out there that can illuminate history and show us why people do what they did, and how that has affected us further down the line.
Well, and this fascinating British cemetery in North Carolina, I just found that whole story just fascinating. Tell us some more about that, if you will.
I'd be delighted to. I have never come across anybody who knows about the British cemetery.
Well, I didn't. And when I read this, I got goosebumps. It's just an incredible story.
Yes, and it gets so little publicity. Anyway, what happened is I was in the Outer Banks,
uh-huh.
and I was on the island of Ocracoke, and I went into the tourism office, and I said, well, you know, what's around here? And she told me about, she gave me a list. She said, well, there's the British Cemetery, and there's the Pirate Museum, and you know, she listed all these things. British Cemetery. So I went, and I saw a small plot of land with a very moving poem and a little bit of history about it. And then I came back, and I actually tracked down a book on it. And what happened is, during World War II, before we were involved, you know, rather right after the attack. We were supplying England with goods and with goods that they couldn't produce.
Right, and submarines, of course, as well. They were sinking ships.
Yes. They were sinking anything they could get their hands on because they wanted to stop us from supplying the British.
Right, exactly.
But we didn't have very many services, very many ships on this coast. Everything was in Pearl Harbor.
Right.
And there wasn't that much along the East Coast. So the British sent their retrofitted trawlers as anti-submarine boats over here. And they were patrolling our coast up and down kind of the midsection.
Right, to keep the shipping lanes open.
Exactly. So that we could supply services to goods to the British. And they were protecting our shores. And they were getting, frankly, destroyed. And many of them were... The debris was washing up on the coastline. So in early May, one of these trawlers named the Bedfordshire was escorting a small band of merchant ships into Hatteras.
Right.
When they appear to have been attacked by a German submarine, and the debris washed up on the shore, then a body washed up on the shore, and the people of Ocracoke wanted to do something for these seamen.
Well, as you say, they, I mean, they knew some of these people, didn't they? I guess the people were visiting. I guess they'd come in for supplies and the usual things.
Yeah. So it's not that they were. Sometimes they had had some drinks together. They had
known
each other.
They knew one another socially.
Yeah, to some extent they did.
Right.
And they were moved by the plight of these British seamen and recognized that they wanted to do something. They didn't know what to do initially. So they decided to bury them in a local cemetery. And eventually that tiny little piece of land was given over to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. So it became a piece of Britain. Because it just didn't seem right that these valiant Britishers would be buried on American soil. So it became British soil for the length of time that it is a cemetery, which is in perpetuity.
So it's officially become, it's a British cemetery, but it's become officially British land.
Yes, we deeded it. United States government.
How amazing.
Yep.
How just amazing. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to experiencing history rather than just reading about history. And there was a little poem that you put in there that I thought was quite good. It says, "If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England."
Isn't that perfect?
Beautiful.
So they hold a memorial service every May, the beginning of May, to honor these seamen, not only the ones in Ocracoke, but there's another smaller cemetery in Buxton.
I'm amazed some politician hasn't jumped on this around.
Probably we're better off that they just
don't
know about it.
Well, I'm next time I'm in that area, I'm certainly going to go check it out. I think it's just a great piece. Now, on a more fun note, you go to Jekyll Island, Georgia. Tell us about that.
Well, Jekyll Island is a terrific place. It's also one that, I don't know, people don't seem to know about. But the historic district on Jekyll Island is a section that had once been the playground of the rich and famous. And it started in the late 1800s when a group of wealthy businessmen, the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers, Morgans, they literally bought the island, and they were going to use it as a private preserve and hunting club during the winter. So they erected a clubhouse and apartments, and then people decided that they wanted their own place, so the wealthy people of the time started to make their own little cottages. They called it cottages. We would call them quite nice-sized mansions.
Mm-hmm.
And they put them up in any style that appealed to them.
So it was their getaway.
Yes, their getaway, absolutely. And one could be a Victorian, and it could be sitting next to an Italian villa, and next to that might be something that looked like a castle.
Right.
And they kind of line up along the the road.
Right.
And then they have the outbuildings, and it's just a totally charming place, and you can stay in the hotel.
It goes back to it's really nice to have money.
Well, you know what my mother always said, rich or poor, it's good to have money.
Yeah, I've always said I've been rich and I've been poor, and rich is better. But, you know, it's interesting because here this group of wealthy industrialists bought this island and built these places as they saw fit, obviously not in the same grandiose manner as the homes they lived in. But in the Dominican Republic, Altos de Chavon, which is in La Romana, they did kind of a similar thing. They built Altos de Chavon, and I just picture it as a bunch of wealthy guys sitting around saying, "Hey, just listen, what are we going to do here? We play golf, we get a little tired. Well, let's build this place up here, and we'll build it in a stadium, and those sorts of things. And then, well, pass the cigars, and let's have another cognac."
That's pretty much what happened on Jekyll Island.
I think that's what it reminded me of, and I think it's just wonderful. there just aren't a lot of islands you can buy anymore for to do these kinds of things. And if so, they probably have so many regulations you can't get around it. But you say that they had their own power plants and cabins for staff.
Yep.
And they just built a whole lifestyle.
Yeah, they had their whole compound there. And they had a good life and enjoyed it quite a bit until, you know, like all things, it changed. And slowly it fell apart. So it was bought back by Georgia, the state of Georgia, who
okay.
now runs it. And you can stay in the hotel, and right. The original Jekyll Island Hotel. And it's really lovely. And it's fun. You can take a tour. They take you around, show you some of the houses.
And you mentioned some of the Tiffany stained glass.
Oh, yeah. The chapel, because these were such incredibly wealthy people, they have a Tiffany window.
Uh-huh.
Louis Comfort Tiffany designed. And I believe he might have installed it as well. And it's just stunning. And it's sitting there in this compound.
That's wonderful. Now, we have about a minute left, and of course your shtick is Manhattan. So let's quickly touch on the Lower East Side Tenement Museum in New York City.
Oh, I love this place, and I tell everybody about it because, well, of course, it's iconic of New York. We ancestors came over and they hit New York and they built the city up. And the Tenement Museum has several tours. My favorite was the Confino tour because it was interactive. But it gives you such a sense of what life was like on the Lower East Side for all the groups of people that came over and hit there and landed there and stayed there for a while.
And particularly, you mentioned the Confino family.
Yes. In this tour, Victoria Confino, which is a costumed interpreter, chats for visitors about what life was like in New York, you know, why her family came over from Castoria, which is now part of Greece, the voyage, and she just talks about what life is like for an immigrant in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And so she told us about public baths and how, you know, there's no bathing facilities in the building, so you have to go down there. And chamber pots, because although there was bathrooms down the hall, they weren't very safe. And so she's giving us all these insights into what life was like, essentially for our ancestors.
And for women, going potty is a major thing, unlike what we do, you know. I mean, Neela, on that note, we've got to run. Neela's pictures are up on the website as for those that are following it online, and they're great photos. It's a great, it's a great article. And Neela, once again, great story, and I thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Roy. We seem to run out of time, don't we?
Yeah, but you know what? We're going to make time one of these days. I'm going to get up to New York, and we're going to have lots of time. We're going to sit around and chat forever.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
That was Neela Schwartzberg, and always a pleasure. I've got to go to break, and when we come back, we're going to chat with traveling chef Tom.